done fell right down that rabbit hole. So reality is questionable. Try, but you just can't let it go. These two right here put on a show. It's paranormal overload with Southern hospitality. Haunted murder mayhem tip while discussing immortality. Locations with a dark past, history that comes to life. Hillbillies with a knack for everything that goes bump at night. Overthinking if you're by yourself, these two will have you turning on the lights. Mixing in a little comedy to make sure it all fits in just right. Hey.
Welcome to Hillbilly Horror Stories. Now here's your hosts, Jerry and Tracy Hall, and their dog Ninja.
Sometimes their cat, Freddy, but never the ferrets.
Hey, this is Nick Roth, and you're listening to Hillbilly Horror Stories.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 393 of Hillbilly Horror Stories. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Tracy.
Tracy, as usual, we want to start by thanking all of our military and civil servants all over the world. No matter which country you represent, thanks for all you men, women, and service animals for everything you do on a daily basis. Big shout out to everybody involved in the rescue in Louisville of the semi-truck that went off and was hanging off the 2nd Street Bridge. That obviously was national news, and the EMTs and the fire department and everybody involved in that did a fantastic job. They were able to get that lady out of the truck.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool. They had a picture, an updated picture. Well, they showed a picture of the guy that did it, and then they had a picture with him holding her, going up, you know, getting her out, just like on the show Emergency. That was so cool. But yeah, he's very brave, and she's a very, very lucky woman, because I don't know how.
Yeah, I don't know how that thing didn't go off.
Yeah, I don't know either. But yeah, thank you, sir, so much for your service. And thank you guys all for your service. We appreciate you so, so much. And there's things every single day that you guys do that nobody knows about, you know. So we just want to remind you that we think about you guys every single day, and we love you.
So, Tracy, there's before we get into talking about the mental health aspect of it, we got a couple of people that passed away that we want to mention. Christian Vincente, who was a Navy veteran up in Massachusetts, he passed away, and we wanted to give a shout out. He's a friend of Dave Dome's, a longtime listener, and Dave's been on the show two or three times to telling his listener stories, and he's very active in the group. And we told him that we would mention Christian. Thank you for your service, Christian, and hopefully you're at peace now.
Absolutely, we love you all. Praying for you.
We also lost somebody that Tracy and I didn't know very well, but we did know, Justin Harp. He was a really good friend of our friend, Mike Solzer, better known as Tragic, who does our theme song at the beginning and the last theme song. And he introduced Justin to the podcast. They worked together, and Justin came out and met us, 5 years ago, mm-hmm. at Scarefest, and we got a picture made. I posted that in the group, but he tragically passed away. Neither one of these people were even 60 years old.
I know. Such a sad, sad thing.
But we just wanted to say that we're thinking of both of them and their families, and may they rest in peace.
Amen.
Tracy, things like that happen, unfortunately. Life is not fair. And sometimes people are left to deal with things like that. You know, mm-hmm. I had a good friend call me this morning from back home, talking about, you know, she had lost her sister a month or so ago. And actually, we were supposed to meet her for lunch before we moved from Louisville. And that day, she didn't show up, and we weren't exactly sure why. And a little later, I got a text saying her sister had passed away.
Yeah.
And so she's having some times, hard times dealing with it. And so we talked about it this morning for 45 minutes or so. And I'm glad that people can put their trust in us. They feel like that they can call us without hesitation. And I think that's very important, to have that kind of trust. But even if you don't know someone well enough to have earned that trust, or to feel like that you can tell them anything, just realize that there are people out there like me and Tracy that, even if we've never talked to you, you're our friend. You're our family. And that's the way we look at it. And never hesitate to send us a message or reach out to us, or, even like the hotlines and stuff. They are set up for people that feel like they don't have anybody, or people who want to keep it private. And so just remember, if you're in a situation like that, please reach out to somebody.
Yes, please do. And, you know, today's the anniversary of my mom's passing. She passed away 9 years ago, and it's so hard to believe it's been that long. But I'm just saying, if you guys have family, just reach out and talk to them. It's going to be more of a help than you'll ever know. I would give anything in this world to talk to Mommy again. But, you know, it is what it is. So, but we are here for you guys always. And if you'd rather call the crisis hotline, you can call 988. You can text 741-741. You have people all around you to support you and listen. So we love you, and please take advantage of it.
Tracy, this is going to be a unique episode because, like last week, there really wasn't any paranormal involved. And we had a lot of people that actually said they liked the story of the Trump family.
Yes, we did.
So,
and thank you for that.
Yeah, so I'm glad, because I was kind of worried about doing it that people would say, this really don't fit with what you guys do.
Right.
And it kind of doesn't, but it was interesting. Well, this story tonight, I think, it falls a little more into what we do, but it's a mixture of stuff. We're actually going to cover Mount Everest.
Ooh.
So there is some paranormal in here and some, but
I'm sure there is.
But it's not a full paranormal story, you know. But I do think that you'll find the stories that go along interesting. Some of it you'll know, but most of it I don't think you will know, because I dug as deep as I could to find some different type of stories that maybe you haven't heard.
Well, I don't know whether to think, I mean, what really to think about these people that climb Mount Everest. I guess it's something you want to do for yourself, to prove that you could do it. But then again, you're like, why would you do that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's so interesting to me, you know, people's way of thinking. It's just a scary thing.
The more research I did on this, and especially on the climbers themselves, it just blows my mind at why these people would do what they do, because it's physically, it's super taxing. It's, well, you know, before I get into it, let's just get into the story, and I'll comment more as we go. It'll make more sense. But I mean, it's not something for the faint of heart.
Oh, good Lord, no.
And I don't know why anybody would put themselves through what they do to climb Mount Everest. So let's cover a little bit about Mount Everest. It is the tallest mountain on planet Earth, 29,000 feet and change above sea level.
That is crazy.
What is not common knowledge is that there are some terrifying discoveries up on Mount Everest and several stories that are unsolved mysteries, we'll say. And we're going to cover some of those tonight. Some of you probably have heard about all the bodies that are scattered all around the mountain, which we're going to touch on more in a bit, a little more in depth. But there is so much more, including paranormal activity, when it comes to Mount Everest. But let's first learn a little bit about the mountain itself. It was built in 1847 by a large group of Tibetan monks.
No kidding. You lie. I was going to say, no, it wasn't built.
It's been there for millions of years.
I was sitting there thinking, wait, somebody built a mountain? Duh. All right, you got your shot at me. Let that be the last one.
Yeah, we've already covered that it's the tallest mountain on Earth. It's located in the Himalayas, more specifically in the Mahalangar Himal subrange.
Whatever that means, I don't know.
Now, I probably mispronounced that first word, but I heard somebody mispronounce subrange. They said subrange.
Oh, well, they're just being fancy.
No, they weren't.
Oh.
So this is on the China-Nepal border. And as far as the summit itself, it's right on the border.
Okay.
So it goes straight down the middle. The summit, one side of the summit, you're in Nepal. And the other, when you walk over to the other side of the summit, you're in China. So that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
There are two main climbing routes on the mountain. It's
the bunny slope?
Well, on the, if you go from the summit on the southeast in Nepal, that's known as the standard route. And the other is from the north in Tibet. So that's the,
all right, the tallest route part. B. Okay. So that's the hardest side.
Yes, I do think that north route is more the harder route, because there aren't many technical issues while doing the standard route, but there are some other challenges when it comes to it. Dangers such as altitude sickness, weather, and wind. Now, you also have to worry about avalanches and something called the Khumbu Icefall.
Well, that sounds scary.
That's actually at the basis of the Khumbu Glacier. Now, that's considered to be the most dangerous stage of climbing Mount Everest.
Is that on the standard side or both?
I think it's on the other side. No, it's on the standard side.
Okay.
Fun fact, the Khumbu Glacier moves an estimated 3 to 4 feet down the flank of Mount Everest every single day.
No kidding.
All right. So let's get to the fun stuff, because there are some unsolved mysteries, as I said earlier, that have left many people confused over the years. So let's find out what secrets that Mount Everest might be holding.
I can't wait.
All right. The first person to ever make it to the summit of Mount Everest is believed to be Sir Edmund Hillary. He did that back in 1953. But that's been called into question. It's been discovered that two English hikers, George Mallory and Sandy Irvine, actually probably did it back in 1924.
Oh.
So what is that, like almost 29 years before that? We know this because geologist Noel Odell filmed them with a telescope. Odell even wrote that both men seemed to be going very strong, and he felt that both would have made it to the summit. Notice my terminology there. Would have made it. The men were about 100 feet from the summit when they were last seen.
Oh, come on.
So it was a mystery as to why they never came back. George Mallory was a very experienced climber who had already climbed Mount Everest twice before this trip.
God bless. He's going back for more.
Well, he did it once in 1921. There was an expedition that was to map out the entire area of the mountain, so he was a part of that. He was also the first Westerner to actually step foot on the Western slope.
Well, that's exciting.
So he was pretty good.
Yeah, sounds like.
He's the one that first realized that climbers would need oxygen masks in most cases to reach the top.
You mean he got all the way to the top and then realized, you know what? I need more oxygen?
He was probably like, you know what? This is it's kind of tough to breathe up here.
Oh, my goodness.
We're going to get into more of that.
I wonder if it's harder to breathe going down. No, I mean, I'm sure it's harder to breathe going up.
Most of the problems occur going back down.
No way.
Yes.
You just can't do a quick slide down?
No, you can't do a quick slide down. It's a mountain. It's not a seesaw. I mean, a teeter-totter.
Oh.
I mean, again, I got my kids' toys mixed up. I mean, a sliding board.
Yeah. Huh. Go ahead.
Thank you. Sandy Irvine was not as skilled. He hadn't really climbed at all. He had never been to Mount Everest. But he had experience in repairing the oxygen masks and the oxygen tanks that they needed. Therefore, he became very beneficial. So Mallory and Irvine, they set out on this expedition with 5 porters and a guide. Well, the guide stayed back, just kind of surveying the situation, until he witnessed a storm approaching Mallory and Irvine. He said, you know, hollered out, and he told both men, you know what, you need to come back. The storm's coming. It's not good for you to be out there. It's not going to lead to anything good. But the men carried on anyway, and that was the last time that he saw them. The next day, a search crew found 2 sleeping bags. that were arranged in a T shape, but they were empty. Mallory's body would not be found until 1999.
What?
That was 70 years later.
How is that possible? That it was just like buried underneath all that?
Well, this isn't like it's, you know, I guess that's part of it. And everybody's, you know, it's a big ass mountain. So, I mean, even though people were taking this route, that don't mean they're all within a 3, 4, 5 foot area, like on a path through the woods. True. You know, you're still on the side of a mountain.
Man.
Well, the camera that he had was nowhere to be found. The only clue that he actually made it to the top of Everest was, get this, he promised his wife that if he made it, he would leave her picture at the summit. And he had that picture tucked away on his inside pocket, but it wasn't on him when they found him, even though he had his jacket and stuff was still in good shape because it's up in the frozen cold.
Yeah.
But hit that picture wasn't on the inside. So that wouldn't have been something that blew away or it would have been inside. The fact that it wasn't inside his jacket meant that he left it up there. And his death came when on the way down.
Aww.
And then they never found Irvin's body.
Never?
Never. So Tracy, there's definitely something strange going on Everest when it comes to paranormal.
Well, wait. I know this is dumb question, because that's what I do. I mean, do animals go up there? Can animals get up there?
Yes, and we'll talk about them later.
Oh, okay.
That's actually part of what I've got to discuss. There's definitely some strange stuff going on Mount Everest, though. Ghost-like figures and strange apparitions have been reported to be seen by climbers on their way to the top. Pembla Dirsch, I'm sure I butchered that, is a Sherpa. And Sherpas, by the way, are because I know somebody's going to ask, they are members of the Tibetan people that live on the slopes of the Himalayas in eastern Nepal. So when you hear Sherpa, it's actually a person rather than like an occupation. Okay?
Okay, yeah.
But they're actually, the good thing about Sherpas is that they are known for giving help to the mountain climbers. So they live there. They know it better than anybody else.
Oh, sure.
So Pemba claims to have climbed the mountain in the fastest time ever, just under 12 hours and 45 minutes. That was back in 2004. But while climbing the mountain, he said that he saw several dark figures with their hands stretched out upward as if they were seeking help.
Aww.
He's convinced that those were the spirits of the dead climbers who couldn't make it to the top. And he actually believes that they're trapped in limbo somewhere between life and death there on the mountain.
No. That's terrible.
Locals and climbers have admitted to seeing things up there as far as these type of apparitions, feeling cold touches, seeing strange lights, and hearing disembodied voices. Some people will actually say that these paranormal activities are not paranormal activity at all. It just could be the result of hallucinations caused by the shortage of oxygen and unfavorable weather conditions.
Yeah, I could understand that.
So Tracy, we touched on it in the beginning, but most people know that there are several dead bodies scattered all over Mount Everest. If you die there, you usually stay there.
Wow.
The rescue missions are just too hard.
Yeah, they don't want to chance it.
So how many people have died on Mount Everest, do you think?
Probably 1,000.
No. Since the 1920s, there's at least 330 climbers who've died on Mount Everest. 200 of those people are still there.
Whoa.
200 bodies on Mount Everest. The most well-known of these corpses goes by the name of Green Boots. So over the years, the term Green Boots became very popular because all the climbers from the north side of the mountain, they have to come across the body of the climber known as Green Boots. He's almost like a marker to a certain point. He's curled up in the limestone alcove cave.
So, here's another dumb question. When they pass away and they're dead for years and they're enclosed in ice, I mean, does their body deteriorate? I can't say that word.
There is some decomposition, but not like it would be if they were down lower.
Oh my gosh. That would be so freaky.
The ice and stuff does a pretty well job of keeping them preserved. Another fallen climber is known as Sleeping Beauty. Her real name is Frances Arsenault. She died in 1998 on her way down. See a theme?
Yeah.
She was able to be seen up until 2007, and that's when someone actually moved her remains out of view.
Oh, they didn't bring them down? They just moved it?
Well, they can't bring it down. It's hard enough to get your own self down.
Well, that's true.
That's why all these bodies are up there. It's too hard to remove them. You can't just fly a helicopter up there and drop down and pick them up. It's just not that simple. You also have a section of the mountain known as Rainbow Valley. This is an area below the summit that is strewn with corpses wearing brightly colored apparel. So when you're looking down, you see all these colors. Those are corpses.
Oh.
Here's another corpse known as the German Woman. Her name I cannot pronounce, I don't think, but it looks like Hannelore Schmatz. She was very visible on the South Route. She died in 1979 on her descent. She remained there for years, but she was eventually blown further down the mountain.
Oh, come on.
In 2006, there was a British mountaineer by the name of David Sharp. David was found in a hypothermic state inside the cave where Green Boots is.
No kidding.
Sharp died a few hours after he was later found. Now, here's the thing.
Wait, you mean they found him?
Yeah, they found him, but he died.
Well, that ain't some crap.
Well, he died because, first of all, he was discovered by a hiker by the name of Mark Inglis. He radioed for some advice on what they could do to help Sharp, and there really wasn't a whole lot they could do, so he continued on with his hike. Even worse, 36 other climbers had passed by Sharp earlier in that day, but most thought he was Green Boots because that's where he was, so they didn't stop to help. And for the record, we'll talk about Green Boots more in a second, but that was the thought. Now, I actually learned a little more. Since I've written this story, I learned a little more about David Sharp.
Mm-hmm.
David actually had lost some fingers from frostbite on an earlier trip, and he told his mom that it really wasn't that dangerous to climb Mount Everest because he didn't want her to worry.
Yeah.
So he had tried like 3 or 4 different times. And on this trip, he decided he wasn't going to take oxygen or any of that. He didn't need none of that stuff.
Well, what a doofus.
And that's what ended up happening. He ended up collapsing up there at the cave. But he had his heart set he was going to do it. But yeah, he had told his mom. His mom didn't blame any of those hikers for passing him up or not being able to help, because she even said, you know, you got to help yourself first.
No, that's true. And,
but I said we were going to talk about Green Boots. No one's exactly sure who Green Boots is. It's been narrowed down to about 8 different climbers who died in 1996. So they were all like part of the same expedition. Okay. I think. It's most commonly believed that his name is Sawang Peljor, which is an Indian climber that was wearing green boots when he left. So that's why they think it's him.
Okay.
So let's get into the reason that so many climbers actually die on Mount Everest. There is a region that's about at the 26,000 foot mark. Remember, we said it was 29,000 feet to the summit. When you get to about 26,000 feet, this is known as the zone of no return. It's also known as the death zone. So depending on who you ask. The air is so thin that it's not capable of supporting human life. Thus, the oxygen masks.
Gosh.
It makes climbers struggle to breathe even with oxygen masks on. It's from this height that most fatalities actually occur. And why it's on the way down, I don't know. But that seems to be the end result, regardless. Tracy, those living around Mount Everest dread nighttime.
Why? Huh?
Well, it's a good question. Because at nighttime, did you think your great question was just going to be a one-word question to you? Why?
Sometimes it works out that way.
Because at night, there is a sharp and loud noise that reverberates through the mountains and it echoes far and wide. So to the locals, it feels as if the mountain is alive and angry.
Oh, this happens every night?
Regular basis. I wouldn't say every night. A veteran climber who actually climbed Mount Everest more than 15 times was the first to actually report the strange noise. He claims to have seen these huge lumps of snow and ice falling from the highest part of the mountain and crashing thunderously on the ground below. That makes a noise.
Mm-hmm.
So the sound was so disturbing that he couldn't sleep. But the question would be, why does it only happen at night? Well, scientists have actually figured this one out. They discovered that the ice starts to crack and the glaciers start to break away when the sun sets. So nighttime is when these things start falling apart.
Wow.
I still don't understand why it does it at nighttime. But
yeah, because you'd think it'd be more on a sunny day.
You would think so. Or maybe it's warm, and then when the temperature changes back to cool,
that's what does it.
I don't know. I'm not a scientist. They attribute this, obviously, to the melting glaciers, to the climate change, because everything's climate change. Next, Tracy, we're going to discuss the cryptids on Mount Everest. You just knew there was going to be some. Footprints larger than that of a human were found on the surface of Mount Everest. Eric Shipton, an expert mountaineer, he came across this gigantic footprint in 1951. They really wouldn't even talk of Bigfoot and stuff back in 1951. You know what I mean? It was a new thing back then. He also found a clump of fur. Now, this was about at the halfway point at about 15,000 feet. He spotted a strange couple of footprints. Now, this was fairly new snow, so it was pretty obvious that they were footprints. It was in the Menlung Basin. He didn't have anything to do an accurate measurement, so what he did was he had his colleague take off his left boot, and he put the boot down next to the footprint, and then he snapped a couple of pictures.
Why have to take the boot off? Why couldn't he just stand in the hole?
That would have probably made more sense.
Yeah.
But they put it beside it, and it was definitely, this print was definitely way wider than the footprint made by the boot. Two times wider, in fact. The toes were distorted, and the big toes seemed lower on the foot than what a human toe would have been, you know, as far as positioning of the toes.
Maybe it just worn them out.
So the question is, if the footprint belonged to a human, how in the world could they be walking barefoot out there in those freezing temperatures and in the snow?
Well, I might be able to. I'm a country girl.
The scientists have actually been trying to figure out the mystery of these footprints with DNA analysis and new innovations in technology, but they haven't come up with anything yet. Oh, and the fur that they found, according to the scientist, it didn't match any known animal at the time.
Well, what the?
The fur belongs to a species of animal that has never been seen before.
Whoa, man. He's one tough M.O.
You say M.O.?
I did.
That's, yeah.
M.O.? M.O.?
Here's a cool but scary story. In 2015, there was a huge earthquake in Nepal, 7.8 on the Richter scale.
Wow.
It killed 9,000 people in Nepal and the surrounding countries.
How horrible.
18 people died on Mount Everest that day. One of the survivors was Jim Davidson. He said it was the most terrifying day of his life. Jim was trapped on the mountain for 11 days, and he devoted most of this time to helping other hikers. Most would have quit climbing mountains after that point, but the 50-year-old Davidson came back a year later when he got to the summit. He actually sent a text to his wife telling her that he was standing on the highest point of the world. And I'm sure there was no surface up there, so probably had to wait until he got back down for the text went through.
And then she said, I'm a liar.
Yeah. Prove it. I forgot to take a picture. So Tracy, we have mentioned that the air near the top is not suitable for human life. But some wildlife actually thrive at that height. You asked about the animals earlier.
Yeah.
There are insects, such as the Himalayan jumping spider. Absolutely love it up there. Their bodies has evolved over the years to make it resilient to withstand the number of harsh conditions up there on the mountain.
A little bitty spider.
You also have snow leopards and the Himalayan tar, T-A-R. It's kind of like a goat, but both of these animals navigate the mountain like it's level ground. It doesn't matter that it's straight up and down in some parts. They can climb and jump all around like it's no big deal.
Well, that's incredible.
I've seen some goats do that on mountains where it'll almost be straight up and rocky and they'll find a way to do it.
Mm.
I don't know. There are Himalayan black bears and there are also red pandas, but both of those are at the base.
Okay. Because like, I ain't climbing up that damn mountain. I'll just chill down here.
All right, Tracy, I got a question for you. If you're climbing Mount Everest, let's say you loaded up on Taco Bell the night before.
And you had to take a dump.
What do you do when nature calls?
I mean, I guess poop. No, you have to hold it.
A large area of human waste could cause a serious health risk to climbers because thousands of visitors come to Mount Everest every year and they leave more than a footprint behind, we'll say. 12,000 pounds of poop every year left by climbers.
That is amazing.
What's more amazing is that poop only has one way to go, down the mountain.
Right.
So the poop slowly slips down to the foot of the mountain, which then, since there's no toilets or plumbing, the poop ends up in landfills, open pits, dumps, and it makes the water pretty much unusable around there.
Oh, I'm sure.
Many people have gotten sick from drinking the contaminated water.
Ugh.
Before even leaving base camp.
That is so gross.
Even the locals who host tourists at the villages that are located on the lower parts of the mountain also suffer from a suitable human waste disposable system.
I mean...
So they don't even the people down at the base of the mountain don't really have running water and plumbing and stuff like that. Oh,
my gosh.
Now... This might actually surprise some of you out there. NASA has made groundbreaking discoveries on the top of Mount Everest. They actually found marine fossils at the very top of Mount Everest. This has actually scared a few of the scientists because how can something from the ocean get as high as Mount Everest's summit?
Ooh, that's very true.
What kind of marine creatures could that possibly be? Well, to some, this is actually validation to the Great Flood and Noah's Ark mentioned in the Bible. NASA has a different theory, though. They think that this proves their theory of plate tectonics. And they say that Mount Everest was actually caused by these tectonics, and they were originally, the top of the mountain was originally under the ocean. And the formation of Mount Everest came
by the monks.
over 100 million years of these tectonic plates shifting. So do you know when I say tectonic plates, what I'm talking about?
No.
So take your hands, everybody out there, unless you're driving, take your hands and put your fingers together straight, mm-hmm. straight across from each other, and touch your middle finger. Now figure if, raise one of them on top of the other, and then raise them again. And every time you do that, start angling.
Oh.
And they're saying what was a broken crack, basically, in the ground. You know, and you'll see this sometime with roads during earthquakes.
Yes.
Where you'll see the road is kind of like broken and one part now is pushed where it's over top of the other.
Yes.
They're saying that keeps happening and happening and happening over 100 million years. It went from flat to being pointed up like that by plates in the earth shifting.
That is so interesting.
And theoretically, that's the way all mountains are supposedly created.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yes. And earthquakes and stuff like that are all... That's all part of these sheets of ground shifting like that, plates. They shift, that causes the earthquake.
Wow.
All right, so we're going to do one more sad story, and then we're going to end on a positive. So there's a very skilled snowboarder who was quite the daredevil. His name was Marco Zeffredi. Now, he would stand at the top of Mount Everest and snowboard all the way down to the base.
Dude, he is so brave.
He also successfully maneuvered the very dangerous Norton Kulwa. I think I pronounced that right. I think it's Kulwa. That's a very steep slope on the north side of the mountain. You know, he actually made it to the summit 21 times.
Are you serious?
Yes, 21 times.
Well, that's quite the accomplishment.
Now, that little Norton Kulwa that he just did, he did this in 2 hours. But he wanted more. So he set out to conquer the Hornbein Kulwa. This was a dangerous route that hadn't been traveled before.
Mm.
Ever. The next year, so he's training for it, right? So the next year, he starts snowboarding over the Hornbein Kulwa. This was after ignoring the warnings of the Sherpas. They had detected a change in the weather. They also felt like that he seemed like he was a little bit tired. But he mounted his snowboard and he started down the Hornbein Kulwa and he disappeared into thin air without a trace. The Sherpas wondered if he was tossed away maybe in an avalanche, but he was never found.
Oh, my. It's always that one more time, you know?
Always.
Man.
All right, Tracy. So I said we were going to end with a more positive story. This story goes back to 1975. There were two British climbers, Doug Scott and Dougal Haston. So they get to the summit, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they got there too late. And when I say too late, I mean it was too late to try to start making it back down the mountain. So this meant that they were going to have to spend the night in the death zone.
Whoa.
The air was very thin, it was freezing, and the weather was, we'll say, anti-life. It's not very good. These two men had no oxygen, no water, and no food. They had a heater, but it was failing. I don't know how these heaters work.
I don't know either.
I don't know if it's something that runs on maybe on propane or if it's something that... I don't know. But anyway, this heater wasn't working right. So it was serving them no purpose whatsoever. they were desperate, so they dug a hole in the snow, and they were hoping that they could lay in the hole together and keep warm, at least till the next day. So they both felt that the end was actually near. They were not confident they were going to make it out of this. That's when something very strange happened. While they were laying in the hole, they both started to sense the presence of a third person.
Whoa. Maybe their lucky day.
The invisible person gave off heat and a friendly aura, as they put it. Then the mysterious entity started speaking words that would keep their spirits motivated, words of encouragement, and even giving them tips on how to survive. A grateful feeling of relief came over both of them as they realized that they were not alone and they weren't going to die. Other climbers have experienced the same thing over the years, and they all regard it as their guardian angel of Mount Everest.
Boy, don't that make you feel happy? I thought they were going to say, dude, there's only room for two in here, in this hole.
Send away your guardian angel.
Yeah, yeah.
Like on Dumb and Dumber, where they were out freezing to death and the bus pulled up. Like,
yeah,
you want to go that way?
Yeah, that is so good, man. That was a good ending to that story.
Yeah, I saved that one for the end.
I wonder why he. Well, I guess they can only do so much angel power.
And honestly, there's probably four or five other stories that I didn't find as interesting that I could have added on. But, you know.
Well, I'm glad there was a happy ending to that.
Yeah.
And people need to take heed of people dying and stuff, and. Just rethink. Go climb an ant hill.
Climb an ant hill. What the hell? All right, guys. We love you. And we're going to take a quick sponsor break. I actually have an interview tonight that I didn't mention at the beginning. Paranormal Connection. These guys were actually right in our backyard when we were in Kentucky. And I never did hook up with them until after we moved here. Oh. I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
But they got some stories to tell us about some paranormal investigations they've done recently, and they got a couple of podcasts out that you guys could listen to. So we'll be right back after this quick break, and we'll tell you what's going on with Patreon stuff, and then we'll hear from Paranormal Connection. All right, Tracy, I am working still on the shows. Hopefully by next weekend I'll have answers for the St. Augustine show and the Casadega show.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a date for the Casadega show, but I'm not going to give it out until I get it confirmed. But I can tell you it's going to be late April. So once it gets released, there won't be a lot of time to react to it. But there's only 30 seats going to be available. So,
well, that just sounds fun.
Good and intimate with us, and history goes bump.
Yeah.
All right. The cruise. Jump on this. Call Robin up at Vacation Experts. Because you've still got plenty of time to make payments. You got all the way through July. At that rate, it only costs you probably $200 a month. Some people will be getting taxes back and they could pay the whole thing in full between now and then. So a bunch of different options to be able to do that. But we'd love to see you on the cruise in September going from Galveston to Mexico.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. I cannot wait to see you guys.
It's going to be a blast. All right, Tracy, what do you got going on over there?
Well, for our iTunes this week, we have Unlikely Suspect, Woodchuck 413, Kay Cummins, Bigfoot 1, Susan Bowman, and Mojo Lobster. Thank you guys. You really have helped us with these iTunes reviews and stuff, and it just keeps moving us up the chart. We appreciate your kind words so much, and thank you for taking the time out to do that.
Absolutely. All right, let's listen to the guys from the Paranormal Connection. Hey, guys. It's so funny. It took me to move to Florida before I finally got some people in right from my own backyard. But we've got Tim and Steven on from Paranormal Connections. Most of them are out of Lexington, Kentucky, but their Versailles is also represented in there. It's kind of the home base is Versailles, which is a city next to Lexington. For those of you who are out of the area and wouldn't know, they're kind of set right next to each other. So it's all the same in central Kentucky when you've got those cities right there between Nicholasville and Versailles and Paris and all of them. It's all the Lexington area, basically. Tim, Stephen, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having us. I've listened to your show for probably the last 3 years. You and Tracy do a great job. I didn't know you guys had moved, which we've been so busy for the last several months with investigations that I haven't had time to really do much. So I've kind of fell behind a little bit. I need to get on there and catch up. Like I said, I didn't even know you guys had moved.
Yeah, we've only been down here for about a month, so but it's been in the works. I think we kind of let the cat out of the bag and right before Christmas, so, and then we moved down at the end of January. Tim, let's do this. Let's talk about, first of all, you guys, obviously you're a paranormal group, so you do investigations and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about that. You also have a couple of podcasts that I want to get into in a little bit, but let's talk about the group first. How did you get formed? What was the reason for forming? How many people are in the group? Give me a quick rundown of that.
Well, we have probably about 22 people in the group. It's a rather large group. And to do what we do, it kind of takes a pretty big crew because we do a lot of home investigations. So we have researchers, we have people that are mediums, we have investigators, and we've got a very diverse culture of people on our team. Someone to kind of do a little bit of anything. We've got videographers, sound people, graphic designers, and the way this was formed is we kind of, our founder started a group on Facebook just for paranormal, and a team kind of formed together. And we've been together for a little over a year, and we just kind of took off. The following on Facebook started growing. And we were doing little small investigations of different places that were considered to be haunted. And then people actually started wanting us to come to their homes. So we do a lot of home investigations and we do a lot of properties as well. Like we call the properties fun investigations. And then we've got our home investigations. We've went in, I think I've been on 8 investigations so far. And for me, those home investigations, it's a totally different experience. Most people get into the paranormal just for the fun or the thrill. All of us kind of fell together because we have a love for the paranormal and we all kind of love to help people. And we're trying to do the right thing for people. We're not trying to scare people, get famous or any of that. We're here to help. And we're really blessed with the team that we have. Stephen there is one of our investigators. We have just a wealth of knowledge within our team, and we're trying to get bigger and trying to help people.
Stephen, tell me a little bit about how you became part of the group and what you've been able to do so far since joining the group.
Well, I came in after the first of the year. They were putting things out that they were kind of like recruit people for the team, and like I said, the paranormal's always been something I've been interested in. So I put in an application and got voted on, got into the group. My first investigation was in Shelbyville in an abandoned mansion up there, and they had been there several times and was trying to get answers to the people that were there. And it's funny because that night there was a little girl that come through and was telling her name, and I mean it was crazy because like nobody on that team knew what my favorite color was or anything, and this little girl was spitting this stuff out. So it's neat to be able to see that. And like Tim said, we're all about helping the client, and it's been fun. It's been something that I've really enjoyed, and you know, I don't call us a team, I call us a family because you know we're all real close. We've got a lot of fun investigations coming up since I've come on, something that we've all wanted to do, and, you know, just get closer, and we're going somewhere about every week, and I think we're booked out all the way till August already. So, I mean, people are watching the podcast and are wanting us to come in and do it, and we seem to do a good job. We've gotten, I think it's 86 Google reviews that have been 5 stars on what we do, so...
That's awesome. You said the little girl was talking back and forth with you. What type of tools were you using to communicate with that night?
I was using the Essence method. So what that is they use necrophonic. We used the noise canceling headphones and stuff. I couldn't hear anything that they were saying or anything, and it was coming through. They were asking her questions about me, and she just kept spitting them out left and right. And playing with the cat ball, and it was funny. It said, "Watch this." And about that time, one of the rock got thrown at one of our investigators. Nice. At the time, I said, "Watch this." It got thrown and hit beside him. So it was pretty cool.
So for those of you out there listening, and you're unsure what the Essence method is, obviously you're using a spirit box. But like he said, you have one person that's got the headphones on, the noise canceling headphones, so they can't hear what the spirit box is saying. So he's got the headphones on with the spirit box, but he can't hear the questions that are being asked, so he's only repeating what he hears from the spirit box. Now nobody else can hear the spirit box except for him. And he can't hear the questions. So, you know, the theory behind that is obviously whoever's asking the questions can't hear what's being said. So they can't manipulate what they feel like they're hearing. So, and that usually, I think that's my favorite way of using the spirit box, to be honest with you. I think it's leaves a little less to the interpretation when you've got one person that's just doing the speaking.
Yes, I totally agree. That way you can get pretty good intelligent responses, and you know that evidence there is hard to dispute or anything like that. So it's pretty. That's what I like doing.
We got a chance to do that at the St. Augustine Lighthouse a couple of years ago with us and History Goes Bump. We're up there, and we were doing it up there, and it worked out really well. That was my first time ever seeing it executed live. And then I've seen it a bunch since then, but that was the first time. Tim, give me an idea of one of the, because I know you got to be careful about giving out certain information, but give me an example of one of the residences, something that was going on there that prompted the owners or the residents there to give you a call.
Okay. We had a house down next to Lake Cumberland. The lady that was living there, she had 3 sons. 2 of them were special needs. And they were waking her up in the middle of the night saying they were seeing someone. And what they were explaining to her was starting off as like a black mass, and then it was forming out into like a human shape with kind of goat legs, kind of like you would think the devil would look. And at first, she kind of brushed it off, and then she started hearing beats and bangs and different things going on in her home. So she called us, and in the process of waiting on us to get there, they started developing scratches. The kids were getting scratched. She was getting scratched. And when we finally were able to make it down there to her, she was at her mental breaking point. I mean, she had just taken so much that she couldn't handle much more. And she was married, but she was a stay-at-home mom, so she was right there in the midst of everything that was going on every day. And when we went in there, we immediately started picking up on things. Like, one wall in the house had a really bad vibration to it. Well, there was nothing there to make it vibrate. And we investigated, and we caught some stuff and got some answers on our spirit box. I don't think we had the Ovilus at the time, but when we were done with the investigation, the wall that was vibrating The man that lived there and gave them the house was a former, he was a pastor. He passed away at the house. And one of the objects that was on the wall that was vibrating was a picture of the Last Supper that had belonged to him. And then in the living room, there was also a horseshoe hanging over the door that had belonged to him. And we were getting answers. We got his name on one of our spirit boxes. We were told to leave multiple times. And there was just a really bad feeling. I had set up a REM pod, which is an electromagnetic field device that picks up on electrical signals in the air. And I had set it up next to her bathroom, which is where she got a lot of the activity, right there next to her washer and dryer, because her utility room and her bathroom had been made in a room that was this guy's bedroom when he lived in the house. And so we went in and got our evidence. We smudged her home, which smudge is the process of taking sage and burning it at home to run out spirits. Our lead, our founder, is Native American, so he goes through the whole process and ceremony when he sages. And when we were done, this lady called, because things didn't die down at first. I mean, she was going, after we left, she was saging every day and did that for probably 30 days. And she had called a psychic out of Lexington after we left there. And the answers that we were getting on our equipment, the psychic was hitting on. And we found out that what was there is what we think was the spirit of the pastor that had lived there. He was stuck and he wanted out of there and didn't know how to move on. And the last I heard from her, everything had died down in there. Everything was kind of calm. And I think that they were moving to another house, but I'm pretty sure she said everything kind of straightened up there before they left.
Nice.
Tell me a little bit. Home visit, oh, I'm sorry, Jerry.
No, you're, go ahead.
The home visits for us, that's more, we take those really seriously because we know when we go in that those people are scared to death. They don't know what to expect. So we kind of, that's kind of what we're trying to do with our shows, our podcast, is educate people a little bit and kind of let them know that it's not necessarily something to be afraid of. It could be a relative, just someone in the home that doesn't know how to leave.
Let me ask you this, though, on that subject. You know, that I completely understand. This is, this, if the spirit is who they think it is or who you guys think it is, that was a former pastor, where would the scratching and stuff come from? Where would the dark entity type stuff that the children were seeing, where do you think that came from if it was the pastor? Because, well, they don't go hand in hand.
What we had picked up on there also, there were there were some Native American battles fought there on the property. It, like I said, it's very close to, I can't remember the name of the town. But anyhow, there was a lot of war and violence there. And we also picked up on there may be some Native Americans there that were a little angry that people were on their land. And we kind of think the pastor was keeping them out of the home and kind of at bay. But we kind of think that's where some of the scratches were coming from. Maybe some kind of elemental spirit or passed on Native American that just didn't want those people there.
That makes sense. You touched on the podcast and what you guys try to do. Tell everybody the name of, let's start with one of them. And we'll talk about what you guys talk about on the podcast, and then we'll move on to the next one. So tell me a little bit about well, I'll let you choose which podcast to talk about first.
Okay, we have our first one we do on Monday nights. We do it every Monday after we come off of an investigation. And what we do with that is we usually bring on other teams and we'll sit and talk about their evidence and what evidence we picked up over the weekend and just kind of see what they think about it. And that's our way of getting our evidence out to the community as well. We show everything on our podcast. We've made some videos, but we're really, really behind on them. So most of our evidence comes out on our podcast. And like I said, it's just kind of buddies hanging out, watching our videos and theirs, seeing what the other one thinks about it and what was there. And we have a good time with that. Like I said, it's kind of an outreach to the community as well, because they can kind of learn who we are, what we do, and kind of get to know us a little bit.
So again, what's the name of that one?
That one is Paranormal Talk with Paranormal Connections. And it, you can find it on Facebook at Paranormal Connections. We have a website that's paranormalconnections.org. And it also streams live on YouTube as Paranormal Connections.
Is it available on any other podcast networks, like an audio version, or is it strictly a video podcast?
It's available on Spotify as well.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, let's talk about your next book. I'm sorry, Stephen, I cut you off. We got a little bit of a delay for people listening at home. That's what we're talking over each other. Go ahead.
Tim, I'm just going to add to what he was saying. Our founder, he formed a team with the mission to help people realize that the paranormal is something that should be understood, not feared. And it was also incredibly important to the founders to be able to help people understand what is happening in their homes. And so those two things are also important to all of us. So there's plenty of fun stuff out there to be done, and we make time for those as well. But at the heart of our team is to educate the public and to help individuals with their paranormal needs. So Monday night show is reviewing our evidence and meeting other teams, but also heavily educating them on the paranormal. We had what Ed and Lorraine Warren, we had their grandson on our podcast here a couple of weeks ago, the Warren Legacy Foundation. And we have actually heard from them several times since then, talking about how good of a job we did that day. We brought them on, and it was raw footage from our investigation, and they talked about how good we did. And so it's actually a real big thing that we do.
Yeah, we've actually had him on as well, and a couple of other young ladies that are investigators for the Warren Legacy Foundation. So it's they do good things down there.
Yeah.
Tim, tell me about the other podcast.
Okay, the other podcast is called Hashtag Paranormal. It streams live on Facebook under the Paranormal Connections website. It streams on YouTube under the Paranormal Connections site as well. And it's also available on Spotify. And what it's for, basically, is it's kind of an outreach to the community. What we do is I have a co-host that's with a team out in Missouri that's called Patriot Paranormal. And we get on there and we talk to the people that are in the community that are having any kind of experiences, hauntings, any of that thing going on in their home. And we let them tell us their personal experiences that they've had. And we sit and kind of talk through that, what we think's going on, what they can do to kind of help. And it's basically an outreach to let people know that, hey, this stuff is real. It happens to anyone. It doesn't really care who you are. If you're in its space and it wants it, then you're going to know it's there. So that's kind of our outreach to the community to, as Steven said, kind of educate and let people know what's going on in their homes, what they can do to help. If they need someone to come in and try to help them with their home and we can't make it to them, then we'll try to find another team and get them on their way there so they can help the people out.
So let me ask you this. Out of the home investigations that you've done in the last year or so, what percentage of them have you found that you don't think it's a paranormal situation at all? It's either bad plumbing or it's a bad air conditioner or something, electrical wiring there. But what percentage would you say is something completely other than the paranormal?
Probably 70%. I mean, a lot of these places that we go into, the people, they've had so much going on that they eventually just, they have to get someone in. But a lot of times, as you said, there'll be knocks that can be plumbing. It could be a loose pipe. Sometimes you'll have EMF loose in the house from wires causing headaches, causing hallucinations. And that's something we try to debunk things when we go in, because we know that, that happens as well. So we're not going in with the mindset that it is haunted. We're going in with the mindset that we're going to try to help these people. We want to know what's going on in their home. And if there's something that we can do to explain it that's not paranormal, then that's great, because the last thing you want to do is go into someone's home. And we have had to do this and tell them that they need to move. And I hope I never see a place that's so bad that someone has to really just pack up and go. That's not what we're here for. We're here more to help and educate.
Okay, so now that you've brought that up, can you talk about that situation where you actually told somebody that they probably need to move?
Yes, that the place that I was talking about before, the lady that was there, she was beaten down so bad, and she was just so mentally exhausted that we actually told her she needed to move. And she consulted the psychic after that. And at first, she didn't take our advice, but she eventually did. Things started to die down, and she finally just got it out of there, because it was, we were concerned about the children, because at first we didn't know what was going on in there. So with the scratching and things, we actually told her that she needed to pack up and go.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm playing devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. I would think that I would be concerned about giving anybody that advice, even if that's what you 100% feel, just because of the fact that if what happens if she moves and then somebody starts talking to her, and next thing she's trying to put a lawsuit because you guys told her to move when it was an opinion-based situation. That's the only thing I would think I would be very hard to tell anybody that's what they need to do, just because I'd be afraid from the litigious standpoint.
Yep. And that's one of the things when we go in, before we walk into someone's home, we have a waiver that we make them fill out, and
good idea.
For legal purposes, in case one of us gets hurt, in case something happens, that a piece of our equipment breaks, then we're responsible for it, not them, because we're bringing it into their home, and we aren't responsible for what happens in the home if something goes haywire, type of thing.
No, completely understand.
So we kind of discuss all that with our clients before we ever go in.
Okay. Well, guys, I'm sorry it took so long to get you on, considering that, you know, we were literally just a couple of miles apart from each other at one point. Now we're like 800 miles apart. But Tim, Stephen, thanks for coming on. It's been fun. And we'll have to have you guys on again in the future.
Thank you for having us on, Jerry.
Yeah,
it's no
thank
problem.
You very much. Enjoyed it.
All right. Yep. Well, guys, best of luck in all your future endeavors, and hopefully you can help a lot more people out in the years to come.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
That wraps it up for us. We will talk to you guys next week.
You guys have a blessed week. Love you.